dives for the angle!
Just to make sure that we're actually fucking recording a podcast.
Are we recording a fucking podcast? I thought the point was that we were supposed to be just the ambiance of two gentlemen at the pub who just happened to have microphones and earphones and a whole lot of other contrivances around them.
Well, the wife is home tonight, so I can't do my usual thing of stealing the bottle of wine and bringing it with me, so I have a very large glass of wine with me tonight.
Well, that's less walking.
That's true.
I just have the extra long microphone cable so I can pick the microphone up and walk to the fridge, as I've done pretty much on every podcast this year, which is
hey, I was
the kind of operation I run.
I was listening back to last week and then before or just after Steph Curry decided that he was Steph Curry again and just destroyed the Thunder in two quarters. And I was just like, yeah, when Steph Curry decides he's good at basketball, there's really not much he can do.
When Steph Curry's not guarded by anybody, he's really quite good, isn't he?
Wow, that was a bit of triple-double hunting, wasn't it?
Well, a bit. A bit?
Hold Westbrook.
Are you saying that Russell Westbrook is looking for stats? are you inferring that Russell Westbrook would be in some way looking to end up with some kind of round number that is completely arbitrary in order to try and prove something to the teammate who left him and the MVP voters who have spurned him so far? I just can't see that reality. I don't understand this narrative. I don't know where it's come from.
The really funny one was they ran like... they run like that action where they screen and then rescreen for Curry to try and get him free. And they screen once and Curry sort of runs around the second screen and goes, hang on, where's my defender? I'm supposed to lose him on this second screen. Oh, he's over there. Oh, okay. I'll just knock down this easy three then. Yeah.
Dubs aren't going that well, though. I mean, apart from a couple of gimme wins against the Thunder, they're not. They look a little bit... Something.
It's six, just, I mean, six and four in their last 10.
Yeah, and the Cavs are 5-5, I think. So
I think they're actually 4-6.
It depends which.
Yeah, 4-6.
Depends
for
which
the last
10 you're counting. Yeah, yeah, if you count, what was the Denver game today? They lost.
Yesterday. Yeah. Denver are good, man. Like that. That's weird how they sort of.
Denver and Portland are good.
Yeah, they made
a really weird time to be good.
They made that trade and both teams got better, which is...
Yeah, it was perfect.
Yeah.
So the trade, folks, in case you missed it, was we talked about it a couple of weeks ago. This is... And I can almost see the waveform of the in the edit where you need to get rid of that. But Nathan Plumlee? Nathan Blacklock. Mason Plumlee.
A. Plumlee.
Nathan just, Blacklock and Mason Plumlee.
Just say A. Plumlee.
Yes. The least shit Plumlee went to Denver. In return, Portland got Nurkic, who was the spare Balkan, because they had a couple of big Balkan dudes, and Jokic is apparently killing it for Denver at the moment.
Who was sitting on the bench twiddling his thumbs, basically.
He'd pretty much opted out for the whole season. He'd given up on practice and training and all the rest of it because he was not getting any time. And that was kind of why Denver gave Portland a first to get rid of him. And then he turned out to be brilliant when he got to Portland.
Yeah, you just get like 82.
Portland beat the shit out of the Knicks today, which was good because everybody likes seeing the shit beaten out of the Knicks.
Mm.
Even Knicks fans, which is interesting.
Getting that tank job. Yeah, they're just terrible. They're just... I can't wait to see. I really hope they get that ball kid. That's just going to be hilarious with that dad in New York with the New York media and Phil Jackson, and you know, maybe he'll become best buddies with Nolan, and Nolan will make him the next general manager of the side.
Christopher Nolan will make a Batman film about him.
That would be quite funny. What about overbearing Batman dad?
Dolan?
Dolan, well, Nolan.
Well, if Batman had an overbearing dad, then he wouldn't have turned out to be some sort of billionaire vigilante arsehole.
Batman being the overbearing dad. Batman has some kids. And then
Batman,
like,
would be a fucking cunt of a dad. He would just be the worst dude.
He would be the guy who would track you.
He'd be like,
where do you think you're going?
Real talk, Batman is a dreadful libertarian asshole. He's like the worst kind of dude. He's like unimaginably awful dude who's just been empowered by comic books. So he would just be a shit human all around, which is how you end up with James Dolan.
James Dolan, yeah.
I'm not sure how the connection is. I'm just going to run with it.
I think I've been looking at movies too much, and I've got Nolan and Dolan mixed up in my head.
Yeah. Nolan make helmets for MotoGP riders. Casey Stoney used to ride with Nolan.
Hey, you didn't answer my question.
MotoGP starts this week. That's about all we're going to say about it, but it starts this week.
You didn't answer my question about Williams. Are Williams still a team? Do they still exist?
You didn't answer my question about... When did you pose this question?
On Twitter.
What? You did not pose a question. Yeah, Williams still a thing?
This afternoon, they had the top 10 up from practice qualifying, whatever it was today. And I was like...
Williams are the white ones with the martini stripes.
What are they? Are they still called Williams, or are they called something else?
They are Williams Martini Racing. They run a Mercedes... they run a Mercedes power plant. They gave their best driver to Mercedes this year, and in return got a shitload of money and a really good Mercedes engine deal, and had to drag Felipe Massa out of retirement.
Okay.
So Williams are still a thing, allegedly. They've also got a cashed up kid called Lance Stroll, whose dad is rich as pig shit. I can't remember what he's done, but he's done something really impressive. He's made a lot of money. So this kid has been... He's a good driver, but he's also been bankrolled all the way through his career. So he's the kind of guy that Formula One fans are waiting to see fail. But he's also guaranteed the financial security of the Williams Formula One team for this year and probably years to come. Yeah.
Is that the new sort of reality for Formula One? You can't just be a good driver. You've got to have a good driver with a bankroll.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, that's why all these Red Bull guys have got gigs. And there's tiers of pay driver. I mean, Niki Lauda was a pay driver when he came in the mid-70s. So, and he turned out to win 3 world championships and was brilliant. But and Ayrton Senna had a huge amount of sponsorship from Brazil when he came to Formula One, from the Brazilian National Bank and various other supporters. So you need a bit of support to get over the edge.
Yeah. So it's not exactly a new thing.
No, I mean, motorsport's expensive. It's one thing that, I mean, you can play football with a ball and some jumpers for goalposts, to use the old Fast Show joke. You can't do that with motorsport. It costs money. Tires, fuel, engines, chassis.
That's why, you know, I always say to the guys, like, touch is one of the cheapest sports to play. You literally need a pair of boots and someone needs to bring a ball, and that's about it.
Yep.
You know, not like hockey where, I can't remember who it was, but someone in their mid-40s that I knew started up in hockey again. And he's like, he dropped $1,000 basically just to get set back up, you know, sticks and pads and socks and boots. Yeah,
but how much of that's necessary? I mean, how much more performance advantage are you getting from having the super mega ultra stick compared to plank?
Like, he'd basically been out of the sport for 7 or 8 years. Like, he'd given all his gear away. He didn't have anything lying around, so he had to start from scratch.
How much does it cost for a stick? And some fucking shin pads?
I think it's more... With hockey, you pay two lots of fees. You pay your club to pay. So you play, you know, your club fees, and then you pay grounds fees, because hockey's a sport that needs to be played on pretty flat surfaces. Otherwise,
often on turf. On indoor-outdoor turf. I understand that one of the biggest problems that junior footballers have in Australia is that the fees they pay to FFA are fucking enormous.
Oh, really?
I've seen David Squires reference it in his fantastic cartoons for The Guardian.
Yeah, he fantastic.
If I could remake even non-football fans to check out Squires' cartoons for The Guardian, they are hilarious. He drops in these pop culture references and Australian politics references that are obscure as fuck. You think he dropped Malcolm Roberts into the last cartoon he did about the A-League. He's a Brit who's based in Australia. So he does cartoons for The Guardian in the UK, but he also does an Australian cartoon every week for the Guardian Australia, and it is always. I mean, if you follow me on Twitter, I fucking retweet the shit out of his stuff because it's just fucking kisses fingers. It's just amazing.
Yeah, no, he's one of those guys that just nails it in a very short amount of time. So
yes,
I was thinking a little bit about the NBA today. The NBA is a sport.
It was better than watching it because there were no fucking games on today that were worth a pinch of shit. Oh, yeah.
What were the games today?
Nothing. Absolutely nothing.
Was there anything interesting today?
No. they seem to schedule all their shit up against the amateur fucking blaxploitation basketball.
Oh, that's what it was today. the Army Spurs against the Grizz. Oh, they're terrible uniforms. Look, I completely understand why they do it. And I actually really like the way the NBA is so inclusive. Like, they're inclusive from, you know, Black History Month right through to the military. You know, they don't sort of
more of a Spurs thing, I think. But yeah, but they do that. No, and they also do the, I mean, right at the moment they're doing NBA Noches, which is their sort of Hispanic, tip of the cap to Hispanic fans. And so they've got like Los Bulls and El Heat and all this sort of shit written on their on their jerseys. Yeah. Bit of a tip of the hat to you know, Mexican fans.
All the people that they're trying to get rid of in America.
The
military thing, because if you watch League Pass and you don't get the ads or the sort of station promos in between, they're always bringing, you know, some guy that's just come back from a tour who's at the game, and they bring him out to center court and they've given him tickets and they give him a jersey, and it's
or they do it by surprise. They reintroduce him to his family by surprise, and there's, you know, weeping on center court and you know, viral moments and all that sort of shit.
But they're just their sort of low level. Like, you know, the Spurs wearing those uniforms is a sort of bigger, splashier thing, but.
These uniforms, folks, are fucking terrible desert camo things.
They're just
with kind of an 8-bit pixelated Spurs logo and numbers on it. It is catastrophically poor, but their heart is in the right place. And Pop's an ex-military man, and to be perfectly blunt, Texas is where the military comes from.
Yeah.
A lot of the kids who join up and go to Afghanistan and Iraq and all that sort of stuff come from the South. Overwhelmingly, they come from the South. So they've got to give back to those kids and those communities, because those kids come back as human wreckage. And it's not as though the government are going to give a fuck about them. So it's just as well the community does.
And really, how do you make a good camo jersey? I was thinking, like, you know, I slagged them off to you this afternoon, then I was like, I don't know how you could design a good one of those. It's sort of like, well, this is the best we can do. It's a one-off.
A good camo jersey would be one so good that you couldn't see the players.
Yeah, that's right. Kawhi Leonard would just...
You'd effectively be just green-screened out of the photo, which is what the Canberra Raiders old jerseys were perfect for that, because they'd be green and the grass would be green. If you could get the pitch perfectly right, all you could see is a bunch of heads and arms coming at you, and that would be scary as fuck.
That's like, I can't
imagine
remember.
That Mal Meninga's head just coming out of the fuck.
So one of the politicians, you know, on St. Patrick's Day, and that, you know, the stupidest thing that you see is politicians wearing green ties, but he wore a tie that wasn't sort of like an emerald green; it was a green screen green. So some clever dude just basically took the video and green screened a whole heap of stuff onto his tie.
That was Sean Spicer, the press secretary.
Oh, was that
wasn't
the press secretary?
I think that was Trump's press secretary, the chemical
I'm just like, you just can't win, can you? There's nothing you can do.
Yeah, he doesn't deserve to win because he's a nerd. Actually, I think he's out of a job now. I think he's fucked up too many times.
Mm.
I.e., he's actually had to tell the story. It's me opening a beer.
The NBA is a pretty amazing season in that there's what, 9 teams in the West and 11 teams in the East in contention plus
the top 7 is set.
Yeah, but the 1 seeds aren't set in either conference, not by a long way.
Yeah, but only by default. The two greatest words in all sport, default. I mean, if it wasn't for injuries and shit, then it's a little bit hard to get excited about that part of it, in that it feels like the Cavs and the Warriors have not been given a fair shake at demonstrating their superiority. Because on a clear day, on a dry track, they would, you know, all you would see would be a cloud of dust on the horizon, but because of extraneous circumstance, they've been brought back to the pack because of injuries and because of other circumstance. Well, it's primarily injuries, particularly with the Cavs and the Dubs.
I think the 1 seed in the West is actually going to mean something, though. I think if you get that 1 seed, you're going to have a much easier run through the finals than if you've got the 2 and you have to play Houston and probably the Grizz.
Well, because the 8 is going to be somebody who's well under 500 and crawled in. Now, it might be a team that's hot, like Denver or Portland, who will be better value than their record suggests, but they're still not going to be a fucking great team, are they?
No, you wouldn't see Denver or Golden State beating the Spurs, Denver or Portland beating Golden State or the Spurs in 7 games. They'd definitely push them. Like, I could see a couple of feisty wins. It's not going to be like Golden State walking over the Pelicans a couple of years ago.
But you could see either of those teams causing Golden State more issues than the Thunder would, as currently construed, because the Thunder are basically Golden State's bunnies right now. They're not capable of anything.
You know, whereas if you don't have Durant for the first round and you got to face the Grizz and the Grizz are just beating you up every night. Like, again, I don't see the Grizz beating Golden State, but it just would tire you out, and then you have to go and play the Rockets that want to run at a million miles an hour. You might get to the Western Conference Finals absolutely exhausted.
I reckon. I mean, they're one of the teams that I picked in my side of the draft, a little draft competition. I think the Grizz will be toast by the time they make it to the finals. I don't think they've got a second gear. They're just going to be out of juice, basically.
Yeah, they're the sort of team that's overperforming by being there.
Yeah, they don't have a second gear, whereas you know, the Celtics get accused of that too. We're yet to see what their next gear looks like. The Hawks have traditionally achieved as much as they were going to achieve by getting to wherever they got to. Even the year they got the number 1 seed, that was as good as they could play. And when they actually got to play the Cavs, they got swept.
Yeah.
So that's entirely possible.
That's the other interesting sort of side plot I find. Is this year, I don't
think...
Can
I just say I fucking hate these headphones? It's literally like squashed. Wearing earmuffs, and I feel like I'm talking into a tin can. It's fucking horrible. Gentle listener, someone has fucked off with my nice Sennheiser headphones, and I'm using what appear to be a couple of buckets with a wire connected to them.
I was going to say...
I can hear the noise inside my... I can hear my brain working. I can hear my tinnitus rattling off the fucking walls of my brain. It's not optimal.
I'm envisioning you with those sort of headphones with the big fluffy cans on them, you know.
They're actually a pair of noise cancelling headphones I lent to my wife to fly to America with. They're excellent for that because they cover your ears entirely, but it means you can't actually listen to. You can't. I find that it's nice to be able to get a bit of ambient noise bleed in when I'm talking on a microphone. Anywho, that's not relevant to what we're talking about. What we're talking about is the Nubba.
I was just going to say that I don't think the Cavs are just going to roll through the Eastern Conference Finals this year. I think they'll get at least
one. They haven't had an opportunity to get their shit together, have they? They really need a rest, which is ironic given that rest has been the number one conversational topic of the NBA in the last week or so. That and sex and peanut butter and jelly sandwiches.
Actually, that was that article about the rest and, you know,
sex, peanut butter and jelly sandwiches.
Well, actually,
not necessarily in that order, but
both those articles, but particularly the sex one and how, you know, players don't have to go out trawling clubs.
You would have seen this story, folks. It got aggregated by every 2-bit pissant internet fucking ripoff site in the world, to much to the chagrin of the dude who wrote it, which is Tom Haverspro of ESPN. But the idea was that some of the home court advantage that existed in the 80s in the NBA, in terms of a team would have you could actually quantify it as a points advantage, has decreased over the years, and home court advantage has pretty much disappeared. And it's whether it's like, has the advantage for the home team disappeared? No, the disadvantage for the away team has disappeared because they're not going out in the piss all night trying to pick up, as well as all the other soft advantages like, you know, chartered flights and comfy hotel rooms and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, it was a great example of how I think NBA is one of the best sports journalism sort of centres of the world, because it was a very well researched. It wasn't just like a crackpot theory that he threw out there. He's actually gone and done.
It was the reverse.
Done the research, talked to players, given hard examples of how things have changed from, you know, the 80s to now. But it's like a frivolous topic, but treated in a very analytical way.
Well, no, you know what it was? It was fucking science.
Yeah.
He said, why has the home ground advantage disappeared?
Hmm.
And he went and looked at a bunch of stuff. What he came up with was, oh, this is a reason, and I can back this up with data. And that's actually kind of cool. Evidence-based journalism is one of the coolest things about this new analytics kind of environment we live in.
So we've talked before about how whether we think teams will try and socially engineer a home court advantage by having a section of the crowd that has very cheap tickets, you know, or something like that. And
having cheerleaders in.
Yeah, yeah. And I know you're not a massive fan of Mr. Bill Simmons, but he had Ballmer on his podcast, and it was a very interesting
I subscribed to Simmons' podcast in order to hear the Zach Lowe one, and it took me less than a podcast later to unsubscribe again, because there's nothing that man has to say that's of interest to me.
Well, the Ballmer one was really interesting because they're looking at potentially going into their own building, and one of the reasons they want to go into their own building is for that very reason. Because LA is such a melting pot of other people that come to LA, so there's people from every state in America that are in LA. So
it's like Sydney. Nobody actually gives a fuck. One's coming to your sporting event to cheer for your sporting team. It's just people are going because it's an event.
Yeah, so and it's very easy to sell.
Fucking munters in Melbourne who'll turn up to the opening of an envelope in the rain in order to cheer fucking Hawthorn B versus Melbourne Demons fucking reserve grade.
I think I've offended the Victorians enough today on Twitter.
By pointing out that they are unable to name food correctly.
But he was talking about trying to basically socially engineer it, basically ripping off European football, actually, and saying, if you want to buy a ticket to our games, you've got to be a member of the club.
Well, European football are in trouble too for that sort of stuff. But in terms of the fact that a lot of the fans at somewhere like the Nou Camp in Barcelona are actually tourists with selfie sticks, and the atmosphere's dead because of that sort of stuff, because it now costs so much that the average punter can't go. But continue.
Well, for years in the AFL, the conventional wisdom is if you want to go to the game with the best atmosphere for the year, you go to the prelim finals, because that is the game with the most on the line, where you have the largest component of fans following teams. Whereas the grand final,
unless you happen to be following one of the teams that plays one of the in-season blockbusters, like the Anzac Day game, or some of those traditional, Collingwood versus Essendon sort of rivalries.
Mm.
You know, go to those games. There's a lot on the line, but it's just a regular season game.
Yeah. Whereas the grand final, 50% of the tickets are sold, 12 months before.
Yeah.
There's a large corporate presence. So the crowd is...
A lot of tourists.
Yeah, and the crowd is sort of loud because it's a grand final, but it doesn't have that sort of hungry, you know, tribal feel that a prelim final does, because, you know, that those people really want to be there. And I've always really wondered about that from an AFL perspective and an NRL perspective, is does that give you the best product for television, having that sort of, you know, it's the biggest game of the year, it's the game more people watch than any other thing on TV, and yet it's a little bit muted. I've always wondered, what's the balance between getting as many fans from the two teams to the game, and, you know, scamming your corporates of huge amounts of money for this one game they want to be seen at. Like, it's a real balance.
But I don't think the quality of the crowd impacts on whether people watch the grand final. People are going to watch the grand final regardless. So that's the game in which, I mean, are you not going to watch the grand final because the crowd are a bit dead? You're going to watch the grand final. That's just how it is.
Yeah. But so
they've made a bit of a cost benefit analysis and just gone, yep, we know everyone's going to pay, so we're just going to cash in here.
But I do think in the NBA, where you've got 82 games and having a home court that is a home court really matters.
And usually only like 18,000, 20,000 seats at the most.
Yep. I expect teams will look at it, because the NBA is so even, every little edge matters. So if you've got a rabid home court section that can influence games in the last 3 minutes because they're really loud and they get into the ref's head a little bit, like, how many games are decided, you know, right at the buzzer? Like, that might actually make the difference between... So then how do you quantify that financially? Like, okay, we're going to lose $5 million over the whole season by essentially giving away 2,000 tickets to these people that are just going to be absolutely crazy maniacs for the whole game. Like, do we get three more wins out of that and the one seed? Like, I don't know how you put a price on it. But I bet you there's people doing the sums, but in back offices somewhere.
I guarantee those sort of people wouldn't be the sort of people who'd turn up to cheer for the Clippers, though. Because the Clippers are kind of a...
They're like
a very artificial, sort of synthetic clip art sort of team, aren't they?
Well, that's and maybe that's why having their own home and, you know, trying to create their own identity rather than just being
they need to build a culture there, don't they?
Yeah, that's it.
All we know of them is that they're not the Lakers and they sucked forever and they had a racist owner. Who are the Clippers? If you take away the identity of the players who are on the squad right now. Your Chris and your DeAndre and your Blake.
Yeah.
Set them aside. You set Doc aside. What are the Clippers? What's their identity?
Yeah.
They're a team with a super rich owner with terrible clip art logo jerseys who used to be owned by a massive racist and used to lose a lot. But what do they stand for? What are their fucking values? Why should you rock up and cheer for them? I mean, I remember your man Bill Simmons said, I've got season tickets to the Clippers because they were cheaper than the Lakers.
Yeah.
And just turned up and watched and played, effectively cheered for whoever was playing them, because I don't give a fuck about the Clippers.
Yeah, he's like, it's a good opportunity to go and watch the Warriors and the Spurs and Cleveland. Like, you know.
I can watch 41 games of NBA basketball and against a team that are, all right.
Yeah. And I don't think Ballmer was a particularly good tech CEO, but I think he's the perfect guy to run an NBA site. He is... Like, he's pretty smart. He's pretty switched on. He's definitely pro science and pro analytics. And he's actually
pro pink shirts as well.
Yeah. Like, he's
and pink heads.
You know, he comes across as a bit of a crazy dude, but it'll be very interesting once the team's his. Like, at the moment, I think the team is still Chris Paul and Doc Rivers. It'll be interesting when he's got to build the culture, or his team has to build the culture. A little
his
bit
people,
like,
yeah.
You know, like the Spurs culture is built from the back room as much from, you know, Tim Duncan and David Robinson and Tony Parker and those guys. Like, those guys built it, but they couldn't build it without the back room guys backing them up and being on the same page.
True. And their culture killed the NBA. Because they introduced resting, which has resulted in some of the worst games of nationally televised basketball on free-to-air television in the history of basketball.
They were, someone pointed...
And they're entirely entitled to do that. But fuck me, you cannot have Dwayne Dedman leading out the Spurs against...
Well, someone pointed out during the Nets-Knicks game the other day that, you know, even the Spurs and Golden State resting all their players was better basketball than the Knicks versus the Nets.
Yeah, you've probably still got more stuff played. But this is the difficulty, is that there's a bit of a balance. We've talked about this before and probably taken a couple of various different opposing hot take positions. But the NBA is in the first year of a seven-year broadcast deal, which is worth billions and billions of dollars. And about, I think Brian Woodhurst cracked down the numbers this week on one of the True Hoop podcasts. About 25%, yeah, about 25%, $2 to $2.5 billion of the NBA's income, that, you know, half of which goes to the players, comes from nationally televised games on ABC/ESPN and TNT. And the teams are clearly trying to send a message to the league by deliberately resting their players for these big games at this stage of the season, that they want the league to change the scheduling. But I'm wondering if this is a little bit of a nuclear option in terms of trying to get your point across, because, admittedly, it's year one of a seven-year deal and the broadcast partner doesn't have a lot of leeway to say, fuck you, we paid you money in good faith and you've delivered shit. But it's just, it's a bad faith way to go about trying to make a point, I feel.
So there's two things. Golden State rested all their players, and everyone's like, well, don't rest them for national games. But the point that got missed for that is that eight-game road trip they'd played six national TV games. So,
well, they were always on TV.
Yeah, so it, like, when do they...
Because they're good.
When do they rest their player? If you're saying, well, don't rest during national TV games, Kerr's like, okay, well, when the fuck do I rest my players? We're always on national TV.
Yeah, and that's an entirely fair point.
And the second one was Cleveland got smashed for resting three...
But I would say that there are different levels of nationally TV games. The true. Saturday ABC... Because ABC is like free, it's like Channel 9 or Channel 7 in Australia. Yeah. It is nationally televised, free-to-air. It's not cable.
It's Friday Night Football.
Yeah, it's basically they turned out the B team for Friday Night Football, which against the Broncos.
The Broncos are always
on Friday Night Football.
It's absolutely it's a political move. And
oh yeah,
in the same way, when
the Cavs did it last week, they weren't starting a road trip. That was purely if the Dubs are doing it, then we're going to do it too.
Well, that's the thing, right? So the Cavs got blasted for resting three players, but they only actually rested one player because...
Yeah, LeBron James.
Yeah, because Kyrie was injured. Kevin Love has...
hadn't really come back yet.
Well, the training staff has said, you don't play two games in a row. So you basically play a game on, a game off, a game on, a game off, a game off. So he was never playing in that game.
Except for the fact that they were reserving him to play the fucking Lakers.
No, he played a game 2 days before, and the rule was with him with his rehab is he doesn't play two games in a row. No matter how many days rest, he plays a game, and then he doesn't play a game. That was what the training staff said he has to do for his rehab.
They could have held him out of that game because that was the first game he'd played back.
Played back, yeah. So
he might as well have... Well, I suppose they might not have wanted him to make his debut in a national televised game at the Clippers.
Yeah. So, and then I think they've just gone, well, we're probably not going to win without Kyrie and Kevin. Let's just... And you can't really say LeBron hasn't been putting in for the league. The dude's played more minutes than anybody else in the NBA.
And if you play him, he'll try and play all the minutes and win all the games.
That's right. So if you put him in a game, he's not going to play. Like, I think Windhorst said, oh, we'll play him 21 minutes a game. And everyone just laughed. Like, you don't play LeBron 21 minutes a game.
You're a fucking bungee cord to pull him back out the court. There's been a lot of conversation about, you know, do we need to reduce the number of games, and how would we reduce that, and how would the teams make enough money, and how would they market it, and all that sort of stuff? The problem is that they're doing all that and extending the season and reducing the number of back-to-backs isn't going to stop teams from resting players. I mean, the Cleveland example just proved that. They're going to rest players because there's a competitive advantage. It doesn't matter whether it's the second game of a back-to-back or they're not playing a game for another 3 days. They're going to do it.
Yeah, see, what's going to happen, I reckon, is... See, the teams and the players actually want to play these big marquee games. Like, that they want those big matchups because that, like, if you're playing 82 games, it's those big games that get the juices pumping, that the coaching staff can really see. You know, they're like mini finals matchups. Like,
yeah,
everybody likes those big games. And what Kerr's point was we would have loved to have played that game like we would a finals game where we have 2 days rest and we go into that game fully prepared. And
yeah, but would he?
Yeah, absolutely.
Would he like to have shown his cards this stage of the season? I think it works out rather well.
Well, except if they tie the same amount of games and they lose the one seed because the Spurs have the tiebreaker, then maybe not so much.
True enough, but I reckon that was a calculated gamble on their part.
Oh, yeah, yeah. But I think if he'd had 2 days rest and everyone, like, it hadn't been on the back of that end, like, everyone would have played and they would have gone pretty hard. I sort of see it from
I've got sympathy for everybody involved. The national networks, even though they seem to be scheduling the Lakers and the Knicks every fucking game.
That's ridiculous, isn't it? It
just shows you that pool still exists.
Yeah,
they wouldn't be doing that if the Knicks and the Lakers weren't. I mean, we joke about the fact that, you know, that big market shit is just shit. It doesn't really mean anything to players. Still means something to the viewers because they wouldn't be scheduling these games if they weren't pulling crowds in.
I think they matter to those particular, like, those national TV games, right? The people that are tuning into those are the more casual viewer.
Yep.
That recognize brands. If you're like you and me,
the name brand shoppers, Carmelo and LeBron and Derek Rose type.
That's right, and not even the player names, like the big brand names, and that's why Chicago does so well on those national TV games. Even though Chicago basketball is absolutely fucking garbage to watch, and you'd never want to fucking watch a Chicago game. But
they're actually better now that Wade's busted his
elbow. Yeah, but
they should have won a game that went to overtime the other day against the Bulls, but against the Raptors. But the Raptors must believe in Roy Slavin's time-worn adage that if you win the stink, you win the match. Had a fight at the end of the game and won the fight and then went on to win the game in overtime.
We're playing the... coaching is really weird, eh? We had a mathematical chance to still make the finals and we're playing last year's premiers and, like, we needed to start really well.
A mathematical chance is no chance. You know
no chance. But look, for our...
Nobody who plays football understands mathematics, so that's
for our development.
They understood mathematics, they'd have a better job than playing football.
For our development, we needed to have a good game against last year's premiers. We played them well in our training camps and stuff, but we needed to go out there and play them well. Started out 3-0 down, bang, 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 and we just looked shell-shocked. And then one of their guys tried to walk over the top of another one of our young guys who took offense of it, all in, you know, pushy, like an AFL sort of fight.
Hold me back.
Yeah.
Oh, no, like a grab the lapels and shake kind of fight.
Yeah, sort of stand up to each other and yell, but no punches thrown.
Not the kind of bumping your boobs against dudes. That's an AFL fight, the kind of the bumping, the kind of, I've got no arms, I'm going to hit you with my tits kind of fighting.
And I fully expected...
Does that happen in women's AFL? I've not seen any women's AFL because the rights aren't over here. But do they do the fighting with their boobs like the same way AFL dudes do?
Well, if Bernie's listening to this, can you go and ask Aaron for us, please? And I expected us to absolutely get right. Like, we're 3-0 down. I thought, fuck, you know, we're just going to get smashed here. These guys are more physical and we've sort of... woken, you know, really riled them up, but it went the other way. Our guys suddenly woke up and it was 5-5 for the rest of the game. It's just really weird that how that adrenaline that added adrenaline acts on some teams, where some teams just absolutely lose it and other teams it seems to refocus them and get them back into the game.
What you're telling me is that you failed to get your team up for the game, and and it took violence for them to actually be motivated correctly.
It was in my my coaching like what do you call it? Coaching report from the coaching.
Let's not get into that.
Actually, it wasn't.
We've cast enough aspersions on the quality of the the leadership directly above you.
It wasn't too bad, the written report. I did a lot better on the written report than I did on the verbal, I'll tell you that much.
It's all right, BZ. Just New South Wales will have you any time. Love to headhunt.
Speaking of coaching, do you find it interesting that the Australian cricket team under Lehman had, we will play our way and fuck the lot of yous if you think we need to change, for pretty much his whole tenure, and then we need to go over to India and they like completely change their mindset to actually we might have to play to the conditions that we're given, and we're going to go and train in Dubai, and we're going to practice to these conditions, and we're going to practice mentally as much as physically. Like, you know, hey Maxwell, you're going to have to go out and not hit a four. Like, we're going to make you go out and bat for a session,
50 odd balls before he actually hit a boundary.
Yeah, and evidently one of the things they made him do in Dubai was, we're going to go out and these guys are going to bowl at you for a whole session's worth of net, and you are not allowed to hit a four. You just have to defend for a whole session. You have to get into that mindset.
Which is the sort of shit we've been saying that they should do.
Yes, that's what I mean.
But this is the annoying thing, is that they've been saying for a long time, our focus is on India. Their focus was so much on India that they basically forfeited the South African series.
Well, and the Sri Lankan series before that.
And they barely woke up for the Pakistan series. But it's clear that this has been something on their radar for a very long time.
Now, will that preparation, like, I'm really interested to see what they do.
Can they turn it around in time for the Ashes?
Well, I'm really interested to see what they do when they actually tour England, because the last couple of times we toured England, we've gone in with the, you know, we'll just play our way and it doesn't matter that the ball's going to move around. Will they pick specialists that face the moving ball well? You know, look at...
What worries me is that there aren't that many Australians who are playing in England anymore.
No. Well,
I would have said there'd be more Australians playing in India with the IPL and so forth. Than in England, because, I mean, since Colpack, the ruling, which meant a whole bunch of basically Commonwealth cricketers could, who were past their best, could just swamp the county scene and be accepted as locals rather than as, like, overseas imports, and were counted against a quota that they had to maintain. We just don't see as many Australians going over to county cricket. There's also the England football style, stay at home because that's where all the, you know, why would I bother leaving home because what am I going to learn sort of attitude, which is why England is shit at football and why Australians don't tour that well.
Well, the guy that sort of jumps out at me, and I don't think he would ever make an Australian side again, but Cowan averaged like...
He washed. 30. He's almost as old as us. He's washed.
I know, but he averaged 30. You know, they did the trial with the English balls in the second half of the Shield season. So he was averaging, I think, 39 or something for the first half of the Shield season, and he averaged like 142 once they changed to those Duke balls. And everyone and the average for batsmen.
And he was probably playing. He was playing his home games in. Was he playing his home games for New South Wales or for Tasmania at that stage?
New South Wales, but I think he played some away games. But like everyone else's batting average went down. Like all of a sudden, bowlers were. And I don't know if you like. I get the Cricket Australia stuff jump in my Facebook feed, and they were doing like little, 2-minute highlight packages of these Shield games, and the ball was fucking moving like a crazy thing.
I did see some Michael Nisa taking a bunch of wickets.
Yeah, and Chad,
it was just hooping.
Hooping around, like, and Chad Sayers is like basically, you know, starting it outside, like three stumps outside off stump and taking leg stump out of the ground.
So we... when we used to do Boxing Day barbecues at my parents' place, we'd get filled up on beer, and then we'd go outside and we'd drag the wheelie bin out in the road, and we'd get a tennis ball and tape up half of it, and a cricket bat, and we'd play backyard cricket on the street, because the street was deserted. No one ever drove along it. And you'd start a ball 3 foot outside leg stump, and it would just shave the off outside of the wheelie bin.
Yep.
And that's basically what you got here with the Duke ball. It just sold wings. And it's a beautiful, nothing more beautiful than a ball arcing, like,
oh yeah,
4 foot horizontally.
All
you can do then is just have a swing. It's just have a gratuitous slap at the ball and hope for the best.
I was playing indoor cricket once and talking to this guy that played rep indoor cricket. And he said 1 year after he retired, Adam Dale went and played indoor cricket for Queensland. And he's bowling.
He would have been good.
He was bowling. Well, you know, he bowled off that sort of indoor cricket run-up anyway. Like, he never had a massive run-up. And so he'd bowl this ball and it'd be so wide that the chair umpire would be going, whoa, and then it'd knock middle stump out of. He was just swinging around people's legs and his control with that ball because, indoor balls swing a lot more.
Great big, the indoor cricket ball has a dirty great big fucking seam on it though.
Yeah.
A big one. It's like satin tilted on its axis.
So, yeah, I think he quite enjoyed playing in this indoor cricket national championship at like probably 40 or something and just destroying every team with this
thoroughly washed
sort of medium pace bowling that was like leg spin because it swung so much.
Hey, remember how Fairfax and News Limited were trying to tell us that this pitch was the end of the
history? Yeah, I was hoping we'd get to this.
Yeah. It turns out that pouring sump oil on a pitch and leaving it for 3 days makes a pretty good deck. Note to self, curators.
And it was
the game
funny
went 5 days and had more to give.
It was funny on Twitter how they tried to defend it. It's like, no, you guys were predicting.
You guys were fucking end of the world stuff.
Like 15 wickets on the first day. This pitch, it was a stitch up and Indian cricket, the fix was in. And the whole time the poor curator's going, no, it's just.
It's going to be all right.
It's a different looking pitch than you guys are used to. It's going to be fine. There's lots of clay in it. It's not going to turn that much on the first 3 days. And that's what happened.
It was fine. It was a good deck.
If anything, it didn't break up enough.
No. I'm sure India thought it held together a bit too well.
Yeah.
Sump oil just held it together.
But
Pat Cummins, I'd just like to say, we at the Ball Podcast never doubted that he'd be a great choice.
Oh, my God.
He would take a bunch of wickets. He'd just be tremendous. He certainly wouldn't snap in half at any point and need sticky tape. He was great.
To be honest, I
watched fuck all of that test match because I was busy watching fucking the Sebring 12 Hours and the Goodwood members meeting on YouTube and live, and of course the fucking amazing Quicksilver and Roxy Pros that were on exactly the same time. Last weekend was a nightmare for live sport, so I actually ended up catching up with this test match via highlights on about Tuesday.
So who won the Quicksilver and Roxy Pro? Because
they were really, really fucking amazing. So this time last year we were telling you about Tyler Wright's amazing effort in winning the women's side of the draw. Her brother had landed on Owen, who's a world championship surfer, had landed on his head while contending for the championship for the world title in 2015 at Pipeline, Hawaii. Bad head injury, could barely walk, could barely talk, was just a fucking shell. She's basically holding the family together, a 21-year-old kid. Smashed the world apart and won the fucking women's the Roxy Pro in on the Gold Coast. Went on to win the world title and was my sports person of the year last year because of that, because she was just amazing. I believe the rights are on Australian Story on Monday on the ABC in Australia.
Cool.
It's an amazing story. So Owen Wright, the brother, lefty, goofy foot as they call it in that part of the thing, was trying to make a comeback for the Quicksilver Pro, and he was talking to his doctors because he's still getting over this head injury, and they weren't going to give him clearance, but finally they gave him clearance. So he serves his first heat, and he feels okay. And he wins his first heat. He said, that's okay. He said, oh, well, shit. I'll see if I can win the next one. And he won the next one. And he beat Mick Fanning in the next one. And he kept winning. And he made the final against his best mate, Wilco, Matt Wilkinson, who was the winner of the same event last year. And Owen Wright, on his comeback from a serious head injury that knocked him out for the entire season, won the Quicksilver Pro, which was a fucking amazing. And on the women's side of the draw, old love Steph Gilmore. I say old love. She's only 29, but she feels like she's been around.
Fuck, she's only 29.
She's 29, but she feels like she's as old as a CWAT lady.
I was going to say she feels like she's been surfing for 20 years.
Well, she'd won six world titles before she was 26. So, but she won the women's side of the draw, which was brilliant because she hadn't won in a long time. It was just a brilliant couple of. It was just. So, yeah, I wasn't paying a lot of attention to the fucking cricket, put it that way.
So I went for... we went down to pick the kids up from the grandparents on Sunday, and I got Vanessa to drop me off at Tugan, and I normally run from Tugan either to her parents' place at Tweed, or I stop at Rainbow and go for a swim, and she comes and picks me up. So, I get dropped off at Tugan, and it just absolutely starts bucketing down rain, which is not the best to run.
Oh, if that's the time I'm thinking,
about 10 o'clock on Sunday morning.
Oh, yeah. Fuck. It was apocalyptic on the world feed.
Yeah, so, but it wasn't too bad because there was no one on the paths. Like, you know, so I'm running, and there's no, and then I get to Greenmount, and the rain stops, and all of a sudden there's just a fucking million people on the paths. What the fuck's going on? It's a rainy day. The beach is terrible. Why are all you bastards out at the beach? And then I come over the hill and I'm like, oh, there's a fair few sponsorship signs on the beach at Rainbow. What's going on? Oh, the Quicksilver Pro's on. Oh,
that
on.
Would be it, yeah. They'd had some shots from out the back, looking back towards the crowd, and it was like looking at the fucking Maracanã in Rio. Mate, it was just a sea of people
drenched.
From the shallows right up the beach. It was just heads everywhere. Yeah. It was fucking... It reminded me of some of the footage they have of... The Rio Pro, where there's no beach, it's just crowd right down to the water, and then the surfers are in the water. It's just amazing, but it was pretty fucking. I think surfing has much better stories than it ever is ever able to tell. I think because it's so niche, people forget, but there's so many fantastic stories, and I think this Australian story on the rights is actually going to be quite cool. But if you think back to stories like Mark Occhialupo coming back from 10 years on the piss and on the pies and on the gear to come back and win the world title, what was it, probably 10, 15 years ago. It's just an amazing story of human resilience and a triumph of the spirit. And that's exactly the kind of narrative shit that gets us involved in sport.
Yep. Well... Speaking of niche sports and narratives, the riding bikes down hills starts next weekend.
Crankworx Rotorua,
which
the town that smells like ass.
I'm going to.
You going to Rotorua to smell like ass?
I'm definitely going to make the pilgrimage to go and see live one year, I think. But
Rotor Vegas.
I'll be very interested to see
when you do. Let me know. I'll come join you.
Well, I'll
bring the pigs for the nose, and we'll get some beers.
they've added another date, so that they've always had four dates to the World Championship, like four sort of big events. Three Crankworx and Rampage, and they've added another one in Europe somewhere this year. I think mainly because the next wave, the first wave of riders were very Canada and US based.
Yeah, and the French round got rained out last year, didn't it?
Yeah, so I think they sort of want to make sure that they have a legitimate European round, because a lot of the riders coming through are from Spain and France. So, yeah. And a lot of Scandinavian riders, actually, which is very interesting. So, Yeah, but it'll be interesting to see who turns up to the first round sort of pumped and ready to go, and whether some of the big guns either miss it completely or, you know, take it easy. And it, like, it's a little
bit like school.
Well, mountain biking's a little bit like surfing was a while ago, where a lot of the money is probably in the videos. Yeah. You know, in the...
We've had this shown before, haven't we?
Yeah, in the freestyle stuff that they make. So, and I think...
In the Red Bull docos.
Yeah, well, not so much, I think, the Red Bull ones, because Red Bull are heavily involved in the competition stuff as well, but the
but they make a lot of docos based on that. I mean, I've been watching a bit of Red Bull TV with the WRC being on there, and there's a lot of subsidiary docos that sit alongside the live competitive aspect that support it and reinforce it and sort of leverage off it, if you like.
Yeah, Anhill Films is the one, I think, that at least makes the best one. They're the ones sort of pushing the, and Tet and Gravity Research are the ones pushing the technological edge. Like, they're the guys doing interesting things with different types of cameras and different types of technology and different types of shots to really make those videos a little bit more interesting than the live stuff. So, but yeah, I'll be watching, and it's a good time too. So, like, I'll be able to watch a lot of it live on the Red Bull TV.
It'll be on 2 hours, 2 hours, 3 hours before you.
Unlike Rampage, where I have to get up at like 3 a.m. in the morning to watch the start of Rampage.
Yeah, so. Some of the American day stuff's a little bit tough to deal with. The American night stuff's perfect because it's right in the middle of the afternoon. Speaking of digital stuff, I know the new digital heads, the new sort of marketing heads of Formula One were interviewed today because the Grand Prix's already in Melbourne and they're asked about new platforms. And they were talking extensively about digital and how they want to get into digital. Fortunately, they said it in such a long-winded way that it confused the fuck out of everybody because they talked extensively about digital leveraging and platforms and all this sort of stuff. And there's all these old school journalists going, what the fuck does this mean? And I actually added one of them and said, what he's saying is we're going to sell shit online because we're tied into really awful pay TV contracts. And he was like, oh shit, thanks, that's awesome. It's like, I need to translate wankerese to old school journalists. But that's the problem. They're tied into these long-term pay TV contracts. So they've lost the access to the free-to-air networks that they used to have because under Bernie they went for the biggest dollar, not the biggest reach. So in order to get the reach, they have to kind of MacGyver a solution out of digital that gives them the eyeballs that they weren't getting previously.
And that's what might kill. Like, there's a real worry, I think, that rugby union in Australia is just going to die.
Oh, like God, wouldn't it be beautiful?
It wouldn't worry me particularly much, but...
It would actually make me genuinely happy because of the sort of people who play rugby union in New South Wales. Just the sort of awful, awful people who underwrite that sport in New South Wales.
You know, they're talking about cutting one team, and I completely think that...
Don't bury the lead here. Let's talk about why people are worried about that. Because they did some participation studies on the number of actual people playing sports. Rugby union has fallen to like 26th, 25th in the country. It's behind ballroom dancing, but it's ahead of archery.
Yeah.
That's not a reason to have your sport on pay TV every week.
Yep.
Particularly if you're just getting your ass kicked by New Zealanders.
Yeah, or South Africans. Like,
well, even the South Africans aren't going that well, which is a reason that New Zealand needs to worry about this.
Because otherwise they are just
beating
back
the shit out of everyone, and it'll be a little bit like the Super Netball thing. It becomes, why are we doing a trans? Why are we putting in the expense of a Trans Tasman thing when it's become unwatchable?
Yeah. Well. Yeah, and then at what point do the NRL just go, well, let's just try and poach every young New Zealand rugby player to, you know, to the rugby league?
You know, they've been trying that for 30, 40 years. The problem is that there's a cultural reason these kids don't play rugby, because in New Zealand, rugby league is the sport of the uneducated brown kid. Unfortunately, that's the mentality. Whereas rugby union is the sport of the, it's the same sort of thing. The grammar schools, the cashed up, even the flash state schools. Rugby union is more important than rugby league, and that's kind of how it. Rugby league is the second option. But
making the assumption that it's always going to be that way is a very dangerous thing to do. Like, if all of a sudden Super Rugby falls over and South Africa and New Zealand go back to just playing domestic rugby, will it always be the dominant sport in New Zealand?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah, it will.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, it will. Rugby, it won't be replaced by rugby league. I mean, it might... AFL would have more of a chance than taking over the rugby league just because of the cultural positioning. But rugby union's not going anywhere in any great hurry in New Zealand, because it can sustain itself internally. And for as long as the All Blacks, as long as the NZRU say, we're only picking All Blacks who play within New Zealand, they're always going to have a pull in their own players. Now, if the Super Rugby goes away, it's not going terribly far, because the thing about the New Zealand teams is they are a draw because they're very good. The problem is that they're a bit too good. You know, you'll go and see the Reds play the Crusaders. The problem is, if you're going to not go and see the Reds play the Crusaders, it's because the Reds are bad, not because the Crusaders are bad, because you know the Crusaders are going to provide a good opposition.
Yep. Yeah.
Why are we wasting our time on this 100th episode of the Bulls podcast talking about the worst code of all? The worst code of all is, of course, AFL. Congratulations, AFL. Your season has started. Sorry. The men's side of the draw has started. I see that you ran your women's final during the first week of the men's, so no one would notice it. Nice work, you bunch of cocks.
It is absolutely amazing how, admittedly, the Channel 7 thing is outside the AFL's control, but
where they have a commentary team entirely made up of old white guys, many of whom are known misogynists.
Well, not even known misogynist, like Wayne Carey is like just an awful, like he glassed a woman, like fuck. I just don't understand, like with all the good positive mood you got out of that competition and the fact that you'd made your sport seem more inclusive,
awfully good at pissing goodwill up against a wall, aren't they?
Oh, it just is amazing. It's almost like. Well, you know, when the sport was going really well in Queensland and New South Wales, they did this to both teams.
Which is
like
a historic statement, because it's not anymore.
No, well...
New South Wales, it's going pretty well because it's got two teams, but only because it's got two competitive teams. The moment they start turning out results like the Suns and the Lions are, and it will happen because of the cyclic nature of the sport, it's going to disappear out the arsehole, just like it. It's not going to sustain that rise and fall.
Well, like, they had boosted Queensland and New South Wales to being legitimate competitive teams in a national competition. And the first thing they did as soon as they became legitimate premiership threats was try and slap them back down and take away any advantages that they might have to make sure that they wouldn't be too competitive.
Because it's not as though that any of the Victorian teams didn't like the power going out of the traditional powerhouse.
Yeah.
Which is, I understand why they'd feel that way, because they'd feel like they'd built the comp up. But there are eight teams from within a 20K radius in Melbourne.
Yep.
That's not a national competition.
No.
Simply not. We're getting on for an hour here on the 100th episode of the Ballcart podcast. We made a ton. We deserve credit for it. We're basically Glenn Maxwell. Nobody expected us to make a ton. We made a ton. And we made twice as many as Sean Marsh. We definitely deserve a gig for next week.
It was a very icky feeling proud of Sean Marsh in that test, I have to say.
It didn't last, though. he fucked it up before too long. Yeah, I fell back this week, as we've said. There's a lot of talk about a night grand final, or at least a twilight grand final, which has pissed off all of the traditionalists, I guess you'd call them. Old farts is another way of calling them.
It gets back to that thing we were talking about before. They already get massive ratings and a massive crowd to the afternoon grand final. It produces a better game because night football is never as good as day football.
I think a night game has better atmosphere. Do you know why?
Why?
What can you do on television at 7:30 at night or 8:30 at night that you can't do at 3 o'clock in the afternoon?
Fireworks.
Advertised gambling.
Oh, Jesus. I didn't think of that.
Yeah. And I didn't think of it either until, actually, I was listening to Roy and HG's podcast, because Roy and HG do a show on Triple M mornings on Saturdays. And they kind of drew the line between the two. It was like, oh, for fuck's sake, of course. There's watershed stuff about gambling advertising on telly, in the same way there was always booze rules.
Yeah.
And back in prehistory, there was rules about when you could advertise cigarettes. You can get a whole lot more gambling ads in if the game's at night than you can if the games are not at night.
Fuck, that's depressing. That is so depressing.
I mean, also you get, I mean, the pre and halftime entertainment looks a lot better at night. That's a fact. I mean, Meatloaf warbling terribly in direct sunlight compared to
light shows
and shit that you can do at night. I mean, the NRL Grand Final always has a better show because of the fact that they can do more production on it. That's not a reason to move the fucking game,
no,
though.
Because in 10 years' time, unless something massively goes wrong and you're known for a fuck-up, no one remembers the entertainment. But, like, I was cutting clips for our new 100-episode intro music and watching that... that Swans West Coast first final. And like, 05, that was an
05, 06?
05. I watched that game. That was an amazing game. Now, how many NRL grand finals, other than that Brisbane Cowboys game, have been an amazing game? Because it's fucking played at night and it's a dewy stadium and it's just never the best game.
Fucking October.
Same with State of Origin. Like, State of Origin is never in Sydney is never that particularly good a game because it's a greasy fucking field.
Yeah, but that's
because
New South Wales are involved.
And
we're not very good at rugby league.
Well, you're supposed to be, though.
No! I'm not sure where this idea came from. It's not a sport
we care about.
You've got all
the clubs.
We're not
very
good at it.
You're supposed to be good at it. That's
no, we just have a lot of money.
Yeah, that's
we're very good.
I want to see the Tom Haberstroh style story on the NRL. That would be quite funny.
What's to say? Well, everyone's still going out.
Cause I'm pretty
why
sure
the Gold Coast Titans always off the chops?
I'm pretty sure that guys aren't, you know, not drinking and staying in their hotel rooms in the NRL.
No, I reckon there should be some team managers for NRL teams looking at that going, we need to subscribe all of our team to Tinder.
It's in, that's right.
Just well, so they don't end up getting filmed trying to have sex with girls' dogs at 3 o'clock in the morning. We need to find a better way of getting Mitchell Pearce laid that doesn't involve him having to go out and fucking
get a club.
Imagine if Ricky Ponting had Tinder back in the day. He wouldn't have got punched in the head, but trying to snog on a Carlotta at the Bourbon and Beefsteak.
He wouldn't have been out in the gutter allegedly at 3 a.m. in the morning.
No, none of that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Ban Tinder. It ruins everyone's fun. So Andrew Fifita reckons he's the most hated man in the world.
Hmm.
I'm not sure he's the most hated man at Cronulla. Paul Gallen. Yeah. Case closed. Oh, there was something interesting that popped up in the NRL. Jason Tomalolo, the Dally M. I think he was a Dally M medalist. Signed
contract.
A 10-year contract with the Cowboys. He's currently 23, I think. And this is pretty much unprecedented in the rugby league. The only thing you can compare it to would be Buddy Franklin getting 9 years out of the Swans. The interesting thing here is compared to... The only thing you could probably compare it to, apart from those, is some of those American sports contracts, like the baseball contracts that are like 10 years and hundreds of 100 million. The thing is that at least in some of those sports, they can not guarantee the back end.
Yeah.
They're going to be paying this motherfucker, whether he's good or not, until the day he walks out the joint or limps out the joint in crutches.
And they don't have a trade market, so they can't even dump him on, you know, West Tigers in 3 years' time or anything.
I don't understand it. Phil Lutton of Fairfax dug into some of the contract minutia, but I think he's limited by the amount that he can actually get access to. And his belief was that it was fairly backloaded, which means it's going to hurt them more and more as he becomes worse.
Well, assuming that he becomes worse, and that the interesting thing...
Well, he's bound to get worse because he's a ball-playing fucking second rower, and he's... Once he becomes 33, I'm figuring he's... You know, the probability is that he's not going to be as good at what he does.
Well, but that's making an assumption that the cap is going to stay at
No, that's a fair point.
You know, like, if all of a sudden they get... a big television, like there's another television deal in that contract. So if they get a big jump in television money and all of a sudden the salary cap goes up by quite a bit, that contract might not look too bad in the last 3 years when he's in that Luke Lewis phase of his career where he's sort of, you know, he's still okay, he's still running around doing good stuff, but he's not the sort of dynamic second row that he was when he was younger.
Yeah.
But the other thing I find interesting,
if he can have like a Brad Thorne second act to his career, then by all means they'll get value out of it. But I hadn't thought about a jump in the salary cap. That's actually, I guess that's what they're banking on.
Well, the other thing I find interesting is now it is beholden on the Cowboys to make sure he gets looked after physically. Do you know what I mean? Like, if you've got a guy for
a long term investment, yeah.
Yeah, if you've got a guy for 3 years and he's got a niggle, fucking just keep playing him. Who cares? If you kill him and you've got intimate knowledge of his physical defects, then you just don't re-sign him and you let another club take that risk on down the road. But if you've got a guy for 10 years, you absolutely want to make sure that if he's got some knee problems, you get him the rest or you get him the surgery early or whatever. You know, like he might actually have a much longer peak with a training staff that is invested in keeping him at his peak for longer.
He could have a Steve Menzies style.
Yeah. Sort of
long, sustained, maybe not greatest ever, but around for so long and performing at such a high level. Tim Duncan peak. You know, just being, you know, not the MVP of the league, but not terribly far away from being the MVP of the league for such a fucking long time.
I thought it was interesting, just quickly to bring it back to NBA to finish, is that Zach Lowe was the only person out of all the stuff I listened to about that, the resting, is the NBA probably got 5 or 6 more years of Duncan on TV than they would have if they'd just played him every game.
Sure, but nobody's watching TV to watch Tim Duncan.
No, but not just Tim Duncan, but like... You know, LeBron had rest when he was at my... Like, they
LeBron
used to
never
rest
has
players.
LeBron's a bad example because he doesn't take a lot of rests.
He has his little two-week holidays in Miami.
He did that once in how many years? He's been playing since 2003. Yeah, LeBron and James Harden are bad examples because they never take any rest. That's why they're always fucked later on.
Yeah, but if you had... the knowledge of the training stuff that you do now and you could have extended Grant Hill or Penny Hardaway's career.
Yeah, I don't like that example because the argument was, oh, you know, if we only had rest, we could have saved Grant Hill and Penny Hardaway. How the fuck do you know? How the fuck do you know they weren't always going to fracture there because they just happened to be physically weak? And I kind of get annoyed by some of the, oh, if we'd only had rest, we could have saved Penny Hardaway. That argument, which is from, because I heard that from Haberstrom, one of the podcasts, was like, you've done all this science and now you've come up with a bullshit emotive argument that's based in nothing like science. We have no evidence to say that these dudes would have survived longer if they'd been wrapped in cotton wool and hadn't played back-to-backs. None at all. It's just an emotive supposition argument. Get the fuck with that.
No, I think the idea is correct. The problem is that especially with the True Hoop guys, is they really feel the need to bring it back to the narrative. And Ben McMahon... talked about it today, is that narrative is still a very powerful thing in journalism in the NBA. So I think what Haberstroh is trying to do...
In MVP discussions and stuff like that, which is entirely about feels.
I think what Haberstroh is doing with the Penny Hardaway or Grant Hill thing is he's trying to put a human face to the theory. Yeah. Like,
but he's doing it incorrectly, and Amin El-Hassan was right to junk him because that was crap. Mm. You know what else is crap?
Yeah.
Flying planes over football grounds trailing banners. Right now, Arsenal Football Club is keeping the industry of flying things behind planes in business, because there's factions amongst the fans at Arsenal who are fighting whether they keep Arsene Wenger or they sack Arsene Wenger, and they've taken to hiring planes and trailing banners behind them saying, "Wenger out," or "Trust in Arsene." And they're basically, there was a game, they were away at West Brom on the weekend, and over the West Brom stadium, here comes a plane saying, "Wenger out, no new contract." And then like 20 minutes later, there's another plane saying, "Trust in Arsene," you know, sort of stuff. And no, it's like, why don't they just arm the planes and have a fucking dogfight and just get it over with?
What they need to do is fight each other over the pitch and one of them crash and you couldn't play the second half.
But it's just the piss-out entitlement of Arsenal fans. They've finished in the... They've qualified for the Champions League every year in the last fucking 20 years. They are stable. They are very fluid. They've got heaps of money. They fill their stadium all the time. They have a fucking charmed life. There are clubs that would snap their own dick off to have the lives that they do.
Hello, my club.
Hello, any club. And they're still pissing and moaning because they finish fourth too much.
Mm.
Jesus, cunting fuck.
Soccer fans.
Oh, speaking of your club, your club's still in the promotion spots, but Chris Wood, their all-whites striker, has scored his 24th goal, which is almost exactly half of all the goals they've scored. So if they come up, he's going to be coming up with them. Of course, Chris Wood used to play for a little club called Leicester City.
Mm.
Who traded him before they won the title, which is awkward for him.
He might be going back down.
No, they should be fine. They've been on fire since they sacked Ranieri. Oh, they're undefeated in the Premier League, and they're into the quarterfinals of the Champions League. So that's great. Oh, I should say that one of the planes associated with the Arsenal banner thing has been traced to a shell company owned by one of the Arsenal directors. I wasn't able to find out whether that was one of the ones that was for Arsene or one of the ones that was against Arsene.
That's got to be someone against Arsene. That'd be hilarious.
I think it was somebody for, but better story if it was somebody against. But there's one thing that we did say we were going to talk about, which was Mourinho complaining that 23-year-old players are all a bunch of brats. Given that, and my argument is always, fine, what kind of fucking mentors are they getting? Given that they're blokes like you fucking brat.
Well,
I mean Mourinho, not you, Bezo.
We know
that you're very caring in your mentorship of young players, except for the part where you play terrible music at them. Case in point, last week's Balls After Dark.
I wanted to add to that with there's been a college coach speech that's been making the rounds about how we only pick players that care and show empathy and work hard and stuff like that. And look, the speech was actually, quite inspiring. If you forget the fact that these kids play for nothing, people they are playing for make millions of dollars.
Yes,
probably make billions.
NBA coaches make less than college coaches,
and
because the college basketball makes so much money and they pay nothing to the players, so of course it goes back to the universities. Of course it goes back to the fucking coaches.
And the guy that's sitting there criticizing the attitude of his unpaid players is probably on fucking $600,000-$800,000 a year. At least, because
no. Times 10.
Yeah, well, like the top
six, seven, eight. $1 million.
So I found it a little bit rich to go, oh, you're not coming in with the right attitude. Fuck, it's really easy when you're earning, you know, seven figures a year to go in and complain that the guy that you're coaching that can't even afford a fucking Happy Meal is not really putting it in.
And isn't allowed to accept one for free because that's against the fucking, you know, if somebody offers him something for free, he'll get run out the program. It's so... The American college sports system is so obscenely fucked up. It is genuinely slavery. It is total bullshit. And don't come at me with the, oh, they get an education. That education's worth fuck all, doesn't it?
No.
Absolutely bullshit.
The thing is, right, you would actually be better off by saying, these people are here to play basketball and we are going to train them to play basketball, but they don't even do that. Like, NBA teams complain all the fucking time about these kids coming out of college and they don't have the fundamentals because they're not allowed to train that much because they're supposed to be, in massive inverted commas, college students who are just there playing a bit of basketball on the side.
Yeah, they've got to create this whole artifice of they're a scholar-athlete bullshit. And this is precisely why dudes like your... the dude I always forget the name of who went from high school to play for the Adelaide 36ers. That's precisely why that sort of thing happens. That's why people go straight to fucking China. They go and play for pro teams that aren't on the level of the NBA, but they're enough on the level so that they'll get proper training, they'll get paid, they can pay off their debts, they can, you know, buy their mum a house and that sort of shit.
And one of the things I found coaching this team this time was, which had a lot of young players, is... they're from a different generation. They've got different motivations. They've got different ways of thinking about things. Just because they don't show their competitiveness the same way you did when you were a kid doesn't mean that they're not competitive.
God, I'm sick of boomer hot takes about how millennials are fucked.
Yeah, and
it's
look...
it's just tiring.
If you're a coach, it's actually your fucking job to unlock that. That is your job. It's not your job to go on
just
a fucking press.
Just as if you're a teacher. It's your job to teach.
Yeah, it's not... you don't go on a press conference and whinge about how they're not men. You fucking... that's your job, mate. Go and do your fucking job, you know?
Yeah.
Your job is to get them better at doing their job. Don't whinge about it. Go and do your fucking job.
I don't know, man. I'm just so tired of hearing old gens, particularly boomers, complaining about the qualities of young people and ignoring the fact that those qualities were imbued in them by their parents and mentors, who were generally the generations that are fucking complaining about them. It's like, oh, the kids today are X, Y, and Z. How did they end up that way? Could it be because you're shit parents and shit teachers? You're a bunch of fucking wankers? Could that be it? Just going out in a fucking limb. Could that be it? Well, speaking of things that annoy the shit out of me, one last thing before we go. Formula One's on this weekend. There's a pink car. There's a fucking pink car in Formula One. This Austrian water treatment company called BWT, they've been sponsoring an AMG Mercedes team in the DTM for a couple of years. They've stepped up, they're sponsoring the Force India Formula One team. There's a fucking pink car in Formula One. You know what Formula One media couldn't stop talking about for the past fucking month? There's a fucking pink car. It's almost like Barbie's fucking pink car has rocked up and turned up in Formula One. There was a tweet from a dude from Hülkenberg who left the Force India team and joined Renault, and the pink car was announced. And he tweeted, "Now you know why I left." Like driving a pink car would immediately make his penis invaginate. One of the drivers for the Force India team was saying, "Oh, nobody, you know, we're gonna have a good year because nobody wants to get overtaken by a pink car." Why the fuck not? Are you all six? Can you get the fuck over the fact that it's a pink car? Jesus Christ, you morons!
Mate,
my sport is run by six-year-olds.
It's pretty bad when the supercars are more woke than the
supercars
Formula
way
One,
more
it?
Woke. Although it was disappointing to see the Brad Jones Racing approached Holden and said, "Well, we haven't got a sponsor for the Australian Grand Prix, but we'd like to run fucking rainbow flag colouring, marriage diversity. What do you reckon?" Holden went, "Fuck yeah, we're on that." So they had this lovely rainbow coloured VF Commodore. Nick Perkett's the driver, former Bathurst champion as a rookie. All good. First race, brake failure, things get smashed to bits. Can't compete in the rest of the weekend.
Yeah.
Lyle Shelton, is expected to have been found fiddling around the front left corner of that car at some stage, I expect. So that's a real disappointment. The cars are fucking a wad of alfoil this stage,
And it's a non-points race, so they're not going to be working to get that back out. So.
Nah, they won't. They won't. And yeah. I don't know. I've mentioned they've probably got a sponsor lined up for the next points round in Simmons Plans in 2 weeks. But it was for a brief moment. It was a beautiful thing that my sport did. I was very, very proud to be a motorsport fan there for a bit.
Hey, Doc, happy 100th episode.
Happy 100th episode. We turned up, triple figures, raised the bat, kissed the badge, and all that sort of stuff.
Didn't thank God, though.
I'm currently lifting up my shirt, and underneath it is another shirt that says 100% Jesus, just like Brazilian soccer styles. And I'm going to go on to get beaten 7-1 by Germany.
I was going to say, next week you'll get banned for four games. So
Yeah.
I'll see you in a month. Catch you, Doc.
Cheers.